All goes to plan. If you could just say what you had for breakfast to check levels.
Oh, I'm doing the intermittent fasting.
Okay.
So I just started.
Okay.
So I didn't have breakfast. But the first thing that I ate today, well, that way I ate yogurt and digestives. You know those cookies that they only have here? They don't have them in America.
Digestives.
Digestives, yeah. I like to say digestives.
It sounds more French.
Yeah, and it sounds healthy.
It does.
Yeah. Anyway, so I ate those at like 2 in the morning, and then I woke up and went to the gym, and then the first thing I ate was butternut squash risotto from Waitrose, which is like rip-off grocery store, right? Like they charge, overcharge maybe?
Oh, I see. They are the
fancy.
High end.
Yeah.
They are the Whole Foods.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Well, they're right below our flat. So it's like Domino's and then Waitrose.
And the food's not that great.
I know.
M&S. That is the real leader.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're like high quality, also high end.
Yeah.
Waitrose is sort of for people who want to show off their Waitrose bag.
Interesting.
Although now, I don't know if you have Lidl in America. Have you?
No.
Lidl and Aldi are these two somewhere European, we don't really know, it's kind of why Brexit happened, shops which have come over here, and they're really, really cheap food. So you can go and get like pastries for 9p and things like that.
Oh, wow.
And it became very fashionable for people to shop at Lidl instead of sort of wasting money at Waitrose. So people would put their Waitrose food in a Lidl bag.
Oh, my God.
And it's like the lady who, when Waitrose started doing, you can just take food and put it in your own packaging in order to help save the planet. And a lady was featured in the newspaper talking about it, and she had driven over an hour just to go to Waitrose for that.
So weird.
She's killed many polar bears in the hope of just recycling some Tupperware.
Yeah. All right, so they have good branding. All right, I'm there. I get it.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is the longest conversation about Lidl I've ever had with anyone, let alone...
Well, it's their benefit. Good for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they should be so lucky.
Let's get them as a sponsorship deal on this.
Yes,
it's currently sponsorless.
Right.
M&S, Lidl. I mean, probably not worked out for Waitrose now after that diatribe, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, we can redo it.
Okay.
Let's see if they have the money.
Waitrose.
Yes.
The greatest grocery store
butternut
in...
Butternut squash for breakfast. So good.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I think the levels are good from that.
Cool.
Hello, and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. Not to be confused with the Paralympian Sarah Story telling stories about the actor Corey Stoll. Easily done. My guest this week is an actor, writer, Emmy Award-winning journalist, and the creator of Tilda Swinton Answers an Ad on Craigslist, one of the funniest plays, or frankly just pieces of art, that I've ever seen. In the play, Tilda Swinton, played by Buffy the Vampire Slayer's Tom Lenk, is a modern-day Mary Poppins who finds a depressed gay man, Walt, played by my guest, on Craigslist, and dissects his life for a character study for her next movie role. We spoke in the performers-only bar at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. In the background, you'll hear other acts chatting away, near the Piccolo Tent Theatre, where Tilda played to sold-out crowds night after night. A few days after our interview, Graham Norton described the show as fabulously funny, and Tom Lenk's portrayal of Tilda as pure genius. My guest and I discussed the process of writing a hit play, how journalism connects with surrealist comedy, what people don't tell you about making movies until you begin, what it's like being the personal assistant to Princess Leia, and why all we really have are stories. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my guest for this week, Byron Lane. Byron, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Of course, I'm grateful to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. So you're here at the Fringe with your latest play, Tilda Swinton Answers an Ad on Craigslist, which is genuinely, as I've said to you before, one of the greatest plays I've ever seen.
Oh, thanks.
It is hysterical, and it's probably a question you've never encountered before. What was the inspiration behind Tilda Swinton? Where did that initial idea came from?
So my boyfriend and I adopted a rescue dog. And she had this, like, shocking blonde hair. And she was both, quirky looking and beautiful in, like, a high fashion kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to decide for a name for her. And he came across a photo of Tilda Swinton in People magazine. And he said, how about we name the dog Tilda Swinton? And I said, oh, my God, of course. And then a short time after, I wonder what it would be like to live with the real Tilda Swinton. And then that's it. That was the idea.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so what was the first play you ever wrote?
This is it.
Really?
I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I would reimagine Alice in Wonderland and stuff. But this is my first play.
Oh, amazing.
And really, I just wrote it because I was frustrated in LA writing pilots and movies that never go anywhere, and there are so many gatekeepers you have to get through, agents and managers and all the, you know. And I thought, well, you know what, I'm going to write something to try to make people come to me.
Yeah.
Now, agents and managers and stuff have not come to me exactly from the play, but I have had a great reward in getting to travel with it and all that awesome stuff. So we're having a great time.
Fantastic. And you're doing the play with the incredible Tommy Lenk.
Oh my God, I'm so lucky. Yeah, yeah.
How did that combination happen?
So I knew Tom in Los Angeles. We've been friends for years. And well, I say friends. I knew of Tom. We didn't hang out. I would see him at parties, you know. And so I had this script, and I thought to myself, he is so perfect for it. And so I sent it to him, and he read a few pages. It took him forever to read it. That's very on brand for him. He's a busy guy. And then he was like, oh, my God, it's so weird. I'm in. And that was it. And then we just did some rehearsals, and Jane Entwistle, who plays my mom, I had seen her through a friend of a friend do a show that she hosts where people read letters to, like, bosses or exes and that kind of thing. They can be real letters or imagined. And I thought, wow, she is just, what a great character. And so then I had this, and she agreed to do it. It was awesome. And then I've known Mark Jude Sullivan for a few years, too. I try to cast him as my boyfriend in anything possible because he's so handsome. So that's where...
He's a good-looking man.
He's a good-looking guy. So that's... that. Anyway, oh, my God, I'm rambling.
No, not at all. This is wonderful.
Okay.
Ramble away.
All right.
Well, that's amazing. So what is your process for writing a play? Do you just start page one, blank page, all the way through to the end? I assume probably not that.
Well, I'm trying to improve my outlining. So... I used to not outline, and Tilda started without an outline. So I just, because I do think I'm good at dialogue,
mm-hmm.
so which can be a downside, because when suddenly, at some point you need plot and stuff. But yeah. It started with just dialogue. I think it started with her showing up and him being confused, and then I just kept going from there. And it was very long to begin with, but then I would invite friends over, and we would all read it out loud, and then the stuff that worked we kept, and the stuff that didn't work I cut, and that's kind of how we whittled it down to, it was about an hour and 15 minutes initially before we started getting involved with Fringe, and then they required an hour, so we really had to tighten it.
Mm.
But all that stuff helps, you know.
Yeah.
It helps you keep just the good stuff, and so I think we've kind of, the version that you see today is boiled down really to the what I hope is the good stuff, you know.
So largely through workshopping then?
Yeah, we did a lot of workshopping, yep.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Was there a particular teacher at school that really inspired your love of writing and creativity in that way?
It's weird because I guess if I had to credit... All right, so essentially I consider myself a storyteller, and that started with journalism. So when I was growing up in Louisiana, I lived in New Orleans, and there was this TV station there called Channel 4, WWL, and they were the dominant TV station. So they were the station everyone watched. So they were able to do stories at night that actually created, like, real change and made a difference. And they had this anchor on there named Angela Hill, who I just thought was just a dream. And
what did you like about Angela Hill?
It's hard to say, you know. I think it might just be, like, the gay guy thing of being drawn to, like, strong women. And she's this beautiful, blonde... strong journalist who would hold people's feet to the fire in town, and she's the real deal. And I think that maybe that's where I got my bug for journalism. Anyway, the long story short is I studied journalism school. I was a TV reporter in Alexandria and in Las Vegas, and that's where I think I learned to tell stories. And so maybe I credit Angela Hill instead of someone at school, because I didn't go to school for playwriting or anything. I went to school for journalism.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, but I think that, so TV journalists, really, their job is to find the best sound bites,
mm-hmm.
From an interview, and then weave a story around that, really. So I think that's essentially what I did with the play. I just, what are some great one-liners, and then we built around that.
And you didn't mention, but I believe you won a regional Emmy Award for your TV writing.
I get nervous because I want to say I'm an Emmy Award winner, but it's a regional Emmy. So I think that just
we
means,
don't know the difference.
Oh, I didn't get a statue either because we were part of. I was part of a team.
Okay.
So that morning, we had some breaking news, which was like some truck overturned on an important freeway. I don't even know if anyone was killed, but I was the main writer that morning, so like I remember writing the openings and all this stuff, and so I felt really good about that show. Mm-hmm. And then that's the show that won, but I think we win as a team, so it's weird to be like that. And I didn't. And the statue costs $500. They have to buy it yourself. It's like
really
they don't just, like, give it to you. Yeah. Wow. So I was like, I don't need this to define my life, but I do, and so I regret not getting it.
Is there like a statute of limitations when you can go? You remember that Emmy that you owe me?
I should look into that. I should look into that. Yeah, yeah. Get my statue.
Yes, because there's stories of sort of 80-year-old actresses losing their Oscars and then it being worked out in various back rooms that they can deliver one to her.
Yeah, surely it happens.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Probably to someone called Shirley at that matter.
Yes, exactly.
It's a very 80-year-old Oscar winner name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're onto something. Yeah, yeah.
Let's get her on the line now.
Yes.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in thinking you were at one point Carrie Fisher's personal assistant?
Yeah, yeah. I worked for her for about 3 years.
What was that like?
That was really amazing and incredible. And we traveled the world. Got to see things that I never would have seen in my life. And so it was a really great. She was a wonderful, hilarious, brilliant person.
When you say you got to see things you'd never thought you'd see. Mm-hmm. Such as what?
Like we went to Japan together. We stayed at a hotel that used to be an emperor's palace that you can only get to by boat. So things like that. Like, you know, I'm just some poor kid from Louisiana, and I could never have imagined doing that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. So what did you learn from her?
I think I learned to just think outside the box. So she lived outside the box, as you can imagine. Like, she... What an amazing life, and... She really earned that, but also the people around her got to see how fun things can be if you forget the rules for a second, or if you lighten up and don't take things so seriously. And so I think that's what I think that's really what I got from her, that you can live a life full of color.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you have a particular favorite Carrie Fisher movie from a writer's point of view? Because she was a phenomenal writer.
Mm. Yeah. Oh God, what a genius. You know, the two things that come to mind, one are her book, Surrender the Pink, which I think is a work of art. I love it so much. And while I was working for her, there was some talk about it turning it maybe into a movie. And I remember typing it out for her, the book, in... I would listen to the audiobook and then type in Final Draft to try to... so that she could have a script to start with.
Oh, I see.
So I had a particular affection for that. And then when I was at the job interview with her, I said to her, I loved you in Drop Dead Fred. Do you remember that movie?
I haven't seen it. I'm vaguely aware of it.
Yeah. She was in that. She had a small part in that. And then so I said to her, I loved you in Drop Dead Fred. And she said, was I in that? And I thought, oh, you're perfect. You're a perfect human being. Yeah.
When Harry Met Sally is one of my favorite films of all time. Possibly the perfect rom-com. And I, for about like the first 5 times of seeing it, I always forgot she was in there. And got a wonderful surprise in about sort of the start of the second act.
Yep.
Where she pops up.
Yep.
And I think she might have done some polishing of that script. I don't know if that's right.
Yeah, I think so. That was all before I worked with her, but I think she did. Mm-hmm.
So who would you count as your, apart from Angela Hill and possibly Carrie Fisher?
God, what a great memory you have. Okay, cool.
Your inspirations?
That's tricky. I'm sorry I don't have a good answer for that. My inspirations. Where my mind goes is that I am always in sort of an existential crisis. What is the meaning of life? What are we doing here? What is happening? And so I think that pushes a lot of my art.
Mm-hmm.
Could my anxiety be my inspiration? Is that terrible?
We've never had a concept before. This is new territory.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're welcome.
Well, yes. Thank you. It's very on trend with on brand with the whole Tilda Swinton aesthetic.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, it sure is. Yeah.
Yeah. What has been the most sort of fulfilling creative task you've had, the creative concept that you've been able to create?
Well, to date, I can say it is the Tilda play.
Mm-hmm.
So that really has changed my life in a way that is, like, for example, people would ask me, how's work? Because I've had assistant jobs and other, you know, jobs that you hate, you know.
Yeah.
And but then once the play started, people were like, how's the play? What's going on with the play? And it does feel like it reframed my life. And then, you know, it felt good to create something from nothing. And And it has changed from, it doesn't just feel like my play. So I've got my castmates and our director, and all of us put so much love into it. And so that creates a family. So this play has been the most fulfilling thing I've done to date, really.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And now talk to us, if you can, about Herpes Boy.
Herpes Boy, oh my God. So Herpes Boy is a movie that I wrote and starred in with Academy Award winner Octavia Spencer,
mm-hmm.
and Beth Grant from The Mindy Project, and Donnie Darko. And Beth's been in everything. She's amazing. So I moved to LA. I was auditioning for a bunch of web series stuff.
Okay.
The web series had just begun. There was this thing on YouTube called Lonely Girl 15.
Yes.
Yeah, years ago. And she was sort of like the first blogger, and no one knew if she was real or fake. Anyway, it was fake. And they were casting for Lonely Girl 15 season 2. And I made several cuts, but I didn't get cast. And then I thought, well, it's not that great. Like, I think I can do this myself. So I bought a camera, and I used a couple of desk lamps, and I just created this guy. Rudolph was his name. And I wanted him to have a unique look so that he would stand out among all the other bloggers on YouTube. And so I gave him a birthmark on his face near his mouth so that it looked like a cold sore.
Uh-huh.
And then people called him Herpes Boy and made fun of him and got him attention that he didn't really want. And then this great guy in L.A., John Baumgartner, who's a well-known and well-regarded director, he saw the Herpes Boy videos on YouTube and was like, let's make a movie. And then he was friends with Beth Grant, and then she was friends with Octavia Spencer, and then all these people were like, this seems like a good idea. And then the next thing you know, we were shooting this movie, and we shot it in 18 days.
Wow.
Nathaniel Atchison from Chapman University directed it. He and I had done like a short together, and he's a genius. And so that's how that came about.
What is something about filmmaking that no one tells you until you're actually doing it?
Wow. It feels like so many things. One is that, I've heard this before, so I don't know if no one's ever said it, but the film that's on the paper is not going to be the exact film that you end up with. And the ability to be flexible with that and find special moments that you weren't planning on, I think that's something that no one prepared me for.
Cool.
But has ended up being very fulfilling.
I can imagine. So do you find acting or writing more fulfilling?
The
or
writing
do they both...
is more fulfilling.
Okay.
It's more fulfilling because it's like, the acting stuff, to be honest with you, I'm learning. So every time I do the show, like Tom Lank and Mark Jude Sullivan and Jane Entwistle, they've been acting for years, have extensive training, and they're just geniuses. So every night I learn something from them.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes more work for me to have a good performance than it does to write something that I think is funny or compelling or that kind of thing. So the writing comes a little easier. And sometimes I just long to be locked in a room and trying to break a story. Sometimes it just feels really good.
Mm.
Yeah.
What was the first story you fell in love with?
I don't know. I can tell you. Probably as a kid, it was Porky Pig and Petunia. It was a kid's book.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah, I should know the plot if I'm going to mention it, but my parents gave me, it was one of those like kid's book with Golden Bridge or something like that? I don't know, like the spine was gold.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, just some kid's book. Anyway, so I guess that was maybe the first story, but I remember being fascinated with Alice in Wonderland as a kid, and then there was a book I loved called The Wish Giver, which is like a, you know... be careful what you wish for, essentially. Mm-hmm. So what was the thing with the doldrums? Was that the Wish Giver or the Phantom Toll Booth? That was another one that I really enjoyed.
What happens in the Phantom Toll Booth?
I think it's like a kid's story of a group that has to travel through this toll booth and they go into like another world, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This could be all wrong. It's been years. But I remember the doldrums from that because they were in like a neighborhood or a realm where everyone's sleeping. It's the doldrums. And so that was that.
It sounds lovely.
Yeah.
I want to check it out.
Yeah.
So we talked about your process in terms of writing a play. In terms of forming a character before you start giving... Do you go with dialogue first? Do you go with character first? Do you have to talk to them in a sort of slightly psychotic way as if they're sitting next to you? How do you sort of make a sort of caricature into a 3D person?
I do rely heavily on dialogue. I am trying to get better at fleshing out physicality.
Mm-hmm.
But so I usually do start with dialogue. And for me, it's mostly... the hardest part for me is when I'm writing for myself. So Walt's character in the play... It's been a process to make sure that that's a strong character and that he has his own arc and his own wants. So one of the things I do when I'm writing is I try to look at every scene and say what everyone wants and make sure that that's there. And sometimes it's even, and this is a fun trick to do when you're watching any pilot or any show,
mm-hmm.
sometimes there's a moment, and most of the time there's a moment where the character will literally says, I want to get out of here. And then I want the money, so I just try to make sure that they all have that. And then a friend gave me another tip, too, that I love, and this was her tip for pilots mm-hmm. that I use now for everything, and that is the first thing any character says should define them. So that the moment those words leave their mouth, you automatically know who this person is. So the where's my money person is going to be greedy, or how's my hair, the person's got vanity issues. And so I try to do that, too, and it seems to help define everyone.
So what's something about writing pilots that you don't learn about from reading books about how to write a pilot that you can only learn about through living in LA and trying to make it?
Gosh, I wish I could say that I had some definitive answer because I've sold a pilot, but I'm not sold, so I'm not a good one to take advice from, maybe. But it's hard. It's hard out there because there are so many good ones. And the other thing that's weird is you can watch something like 30 Rock, which is a masterpiece, I think. And that pilot, the episode one is actually the first half of the original pilot. So it's broken up, and so there's not you can't like outline it the same that you could with other shows. So maybe there's no secret. And also these days, like, there are so many... outlets. So mm-hmm. Amazon's producing stuff, Netflix is producing stuff. Netflix just did a show that's 15 minutes, a show called Special, which is really lovely. And so maybe there are no rules. I mean, maybe people are looking for something fresh. So I don't know, follow your gut, you know?
Do you feel this proliferation of channels and the invention of the internet has helped storytellers or hindered them in a direct or indirect way?
Gosh, I mean, I guess... It must be help, right? Because in the old days where they do get in the Coliseum and watch some play, and now you can watch gazillions of things. So it must be helpful. As a consumer of that stuff, sometimes for me it's frustrating because it's so much. And you can spend an evening just scrolling through Netflix, fighting with your partner about what to watch. You know?
Yeah, it's always longer than the whatever show you, even if it's
yes.
The extended cut of all of The Lord of the Rings. You will spend more time than that.
100%.
Just yep. finding the actual one.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's become oversaturated?
Maybe, right? I mean, has it? Maybe it's not even a feeling. Like, maybe they would all agree. You know, it might not be controversial to say it's oversaturated. Gosh, I was just reading something about how someone's going into... Maybe it's HBO is investing in short-form shows. So it'll be like out here in the UK, I think they do shows that are just like 6 episodes, and that's a season.
That the BBC would only ever commission 6
yeah.
episodes.
Yeah, but it's actually kind of lovely.
It does seem self-contained.
Yeah.
And you need the barriers in order to flesh out the room, really. You need the walls to make the room.
Yeah.
Fawlty Towers, famously, only has, I think, 12 episodes.
Oh, wow.
And they were 4 years apart because Connie Booth and John Cleese got divorced in the middle.
Oh, my God. I love it.
And they used to have, they would just write on the walls when they had an idea. So apparently the bathroom was just filled with plot ideas and...
art.
I know.
That's so cool. Yes.
What was a particular show or sitcom you had that you loved when you were growing up?
Well, I loved He-Man as a kid. He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
And then I remember being into the TV show Dallas, but only because my parents were into it. And then I got into theme songs. So I love the theme music to Dallas, and I love the theme music to Cagney and Lacey.
Mm-hmm.
It's like cop drama about these two ladies in New York, I think. Is it New York? Maybe Boston. I don't know. So those were some of the shows that I watched. And then as I got older and appreciated it all more, like 30 Rock is my favorite. Arrested Development, so funny. They were very outside the box, too, you know.
Who are some writers at the moment that you particularly love that perhaps need more publicity?
Oh, gosh. Well, my mind just goes right here to Fringe. There are a couple of geniuses here. David William Bryant is a genius. He's got a show here called In Loyal Company, and there's a second show he's doing about a drug addict, and people like him, I'm just so inspired. So he's doing one-man show. So this is a one-man show he wrote based on a family member, and it's about the war, and he plays every character, and it's so compelling, and I was crying, and so, like, he's someone I'm cheering on right now. And I'm excited to see some of the other works here, too, like Unfortunate's brilliant. There's a great show here called Sleeping Giants, written by a guy who is a writer for Supernatural,
cool.
The TV show.
Yeah.
And the play is very, like, it was an hour, but I wish it was three, because there was a monster, and it was scary, and the acting is so amazing. So, I don't know, I'm cheering those folks on.
Wonderful. Well, my final question is quite a broad one, which is, why do we need stories?
God, oh my God, what a good question. Well, I'm into this self-help lady right now named Byron Katie. We have the same name.
Yeah.
My understanding of her, one of her philosophies is that everyone can only exist inside of us, so everything has to be processed through our senses and then our mind, whatever electrical things it's doing to whatever we take in. So one school of thought is that stories are all we have. So I've met you, but I'm saying some story about you in my mind. I've decided what you look like and what space you take up, and so stories really are all we have.
Wow. That's incredibly profound.
Is it? I don't know. Does it sound crazy?
No, not at all.
And what if Byron Katie hears this and she's like, I don't believe this at all?
I know she's a big fan.
All right.
So it's very certain.
Okay, all right.
In fact, she's calling now. So we'll screen that call and she'll get back to you. Byron, thanks so much for talking to me.
Are you kidding? Thanks. Thanks for coming to the show. Nice to meet you.
Oh, it's really lovely to meet you too. And I can't wait to see Tilda on the West End stage.
Yes. Thanks, friend.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much again.
Sure.
Thank you.